Today is November 23rd, 1973, a Friday. The following interview is with Catherine Bulow, B-U-L-O-W, a secretary in the Office of Congressional Relations. She worked primarily with Mr. William Timmons throughout her tenure on the White House staff. The interview will take place in Ms. Bulow's new office at 1701 Pennsylvania Avenue, room 335. The interviewer is Terry Good. Questions, we just answer them as best you can. We just have a good time. You joined the White House staff right at the beginning of the administration, and I suppose you were also working during the transition period and maybe during the six-week campaign, is that right?
Yes. I started out with a convention in 68 working for the National Committee. And then after Mr. Nixon was nominated, I started out working for the answer desk, which was a function of the Republican National Committee.
So that would have been what, in July of 68, August of 68?
July. It was late July.
How did you come to join them in July of 68?
Well, like I said, I was already a functionary of the Republican National Committee. And they were given certain responsibilities during the campaign. And I stayed through those responsibilities until after the successful election.
When did you join the RNC?
In September of 1967.
How did you come to join the RNC?
Well, I worked for the government, and I was a little bored with it, and politics sounded more exciting.
Sometimes it's interesting to trace how people become affiliated with the administration. All right, so your last day on the White House staff was...
Officially, it was last Friday, but I went on annual leave, and my real last day was late September. I think it was September 28th or something, 27th, 28th.
The entire time that you were on the White House staff, you were working with Bill Timmons in the office that deals with Capitol Hill, and I won't try to name the title of it because, as you've already indicated before I turn the tape on, it's changed. So why don't you tell me what the title has been through the years that you've been affiliated with it?
Well, we start out as Congressional Relations, and then after the 72 election, they changed it to Legislative Affairs. So now it's the Office of Legislative Affairs.
And I am right. The whole time that you were in that, you were more or less working with Bill Timmons.
Well, I worked for Bill Timmons, but during the period of the president-elect, I was assigned to both Bryce Harlow and Bill Timmons up in New York. Although, you know, it's always been understood I worked for Bill Timmons.
How many different titles have you held while you've been in that office, Kate?
That's sort of unfair because we never kept much count. It was, administrative secretary, executive secretary, staff secretariat, a few others. Catch as catch can.
If you had to identify yourself now for someone, which of those titles do you think would be most appropriate? Obviously, you were more than just an ordinary secretary or receptionist.
Well, I use it executive secretary, only because that means that you have about 10 people underneath you. I think in reality it was more like administrative assistant.
This reference to 10 people under you, were there other people in fact that reported to you during these years that you were there?
Two or three. We had a very good working relationship with the whole staff, and the fellas were very candid and felt that the girls could comprehend or handle what they came in, and I could give assignments to the fellas too through Bill. You're talking about Tom and Max and so on. But it was a very fluid operation.
Now, when you refer to Tom and Max, it's Tom...
Corlogus and Max. Yeah, Max Friederstrom. Because they never questioned the fact that it was coming from Bill. And it was that type of operation. It was very fluid.
Who were some of the other... sounds like a male chauvinist. Who were the other women in the office who might have been responsible for secretarial chores that might have reported to you or weren't under you?
Well, we had, secretaries for every one of the men. And Nancy Kennedy, which comes to mind, joined Bill and I when we were just a two-people operation. And Nancy ended up working for Max. But she knows the operation as well as I do. And in the long run, is very, very smart and keen about it. Eloise Freyer was in there from day one. She runs the three-girl correspondence unit. Got Eloise, Virginia Olson, and Jan Kogan. That's little correspondence only. And the girls have sort of fluctuated around the men because we've had men drop off and men stay and so on. And of the hardcore group, that's about it. Nita Brown used to work for Dick Cook and is now with Gene Ainsworth. She's been with us for about 4 years.
So each one of these people were more or less assigned to
an individual.
An individual.
Yeah, a male individual.
And would have reported to him as often as having reported to you.
Yeah, well, they didn't really report to me, but I could give them assignments with a condonance or condolence or whatever that word is. The fellas didn't gripe.
Okay, all right, all right. You've named Corlogus and Friedersdorf. Now, there were other men in the office from 69 on who have come and gone. Who were some of these others that perhaps were there for a period of time and come to mind that you might have had a lot of contact with?
Well, we had Dick Cook, who went to Lockheed, was there from August to 69 as a house guy. And Ken Ballou started out with his day one. He went on to Army as undersecretary. Dale Grubb went over to NASA. And John Niedecker, who was our special projects fellow, was there for quite a while. And we haven't really had, I think, to call it turnover, more than additions. We lost Jim Sparling, who was with us for a very short time, but he worked for Jim Harvey, and Jim Harvey's going to get a judgeship or some silly thing, and Jim's going to run for his seat.
Oh, God.
And that type of progressment, but I don't think we've had a great turnover. Bill Castman went to GSA as general counsel. That's really about the group. If I can remember, I might be missing one or two, but not that many.
During this entire time, the head of the office was initially Bryce Harlow, and then Bill Timmons, and then Clark McGregor, and then back to Bill Timmons, as I understand. Is that right?
Well, Bill never changed his title. After Mr. Harlow left, Timmons' title never changed. When McGregor was brought in, he was giving a title like counsel to the president for legislative affairs. And the understanding was that Timmons would retain the operating stature and that Mr. McGregor would be involved in more policy-oriented things. So the function really never changed from the time that Harlow left until date certain, except that Timmons, when McGregor left, assumed more policy-making decisions.
Whose responsibility was it, or who actually decided how the office should be set up when you first came in January of 69?
Mr. Harlow.
Did he sit down and say, okay, I want some guys to handle the House side, I want some guys to handle the Senate side?
That's correct.
And then did he make the assignments?
Yes, he had his own shop lined up, ideas made, and staffed it accordingly.
And he looked to Bill Timmons to handle the House side? Did he expect the people under him to be spending a lot of time up on the Hill as well as down in the east wing of the White House where the office initially was? Or did he...
No, the office initially was in the west wing.
Oh, it was?
The congressional staff was the second floor of the west wing. Mr. Harlow was on the first floor. And the congressional shop was upstairs with Mr. Ballou, Mr. Timmons, and Dale Grubb. We're all upstairs on the second floor of the west wing for about 9 months.
Why did they decide to move it over to the east wing? Because it was just too large?
They expanded the staff.
So Timmons then moved over to the east wing at that point?
Everybody in congressional moved over to the east wing, excluding Harlow.
Did the administrative structure or the organizational structure of the office change to any noticeable degree from Harlow, Timmons, McGregor, or did it pretty much remain as it was initially set up with Harlow?
Well, you'd have to take into consideration the expansion of the staff, for one thing. Physically and administratively, it remains status quo. With Harlow in the west wing and the whole staff in the east wing, there was a communications problem. But when Mr. Harlow left and everything was handled out of the east wing, it was sort of an in-house function. We had a correspondence unit that handled all the presidential mail and all the substance mail. And the House and Senate girls would handle mediocre mail, you know, the routine stuff. But then when it was reverted back to Mr. McGregor, we ran into the confusion again of the mail being transferred from the east to west wing. And he wanted to see the substance mail, which meant a lag in acknowledgments and just the regular housekeeping problems of the logistics. So you can't say it stayed status quo, only in as much as the staff remained the same. But you ran into the same logistical problem you had with Harlow a year before.
But other than that, all three of these men, Harlow, Timmons, and McGregor, ran the operation pretty much the same way, excluding perhaps personality differences. Or did one of them assume more responsibility for contacting senators and representatives and perhaps another one, or did each one simply assign their assistants the responsibility for the contact on the Hill and let them do it? Did they remain out of it? Or?
Well, I think it was pretty much run similar. You'd have to understand the nature of the animal in the Congress. Harlow, McGregor, and Timmons all would respond to the senior members and try and respond as best they could to the others. If they couldn't, they would delegate it to their juniors. And because of this, like I said, we had logistical problems and calling over to the East Wing and telling so-and-so and such, and that's one of our big problems was getting through. You'd call the girl and tell her, and she didn't appreciate the importance of it at the time, but I think it was run basically the same way, other than personalities.
Did Timmons spend a lot of time up on the Hill?
No, he didn't.
So he operated pretty much out of the White House?
He was always accessible to the phone. He was always there.
Was that true of Harlow and McGregor?
No, Mr. Harlow was most of the time tied up in meetings, as was McGregor. Timmons is also, but I think the latter two, spent more time on the Hill than Bill Timmons does. I think Timmons relies more on his deputies to feel the temperature, and if there's a great problem, he'll be up there.
In your role, were you in constant contact with members of the House and the Senate?
Yes,
sir. Did they on occasion call and just want to talk with you about a problem?
Well, it depends on the magnitude of the problem, as you know, individuals. They would call on many occasions and talk to the secretaries if the boss wasn't available. They wouldn't get into detail problems, you know, like grants and loans and stuff, because it's sort of privy information. But we never had any communications problem with them.
So they actually looked to you as Bill Timmons' assistant rather than his secretary?
I think many of them did, that I talked to often.
Did Bill ever assign you any projects, ones that might take more than just an hour or something like that? Did you have any ongoing projects that you were responsible for day in and day out?
My favorite, I was in charge of socials. Well, we had the dubious distinction of picking congressmen and senators to come to state dinners.
Oh, really?
Sure. I'd submit my little list of recommendations and staff members, and that was one of my favorites. I enjoyed that. I could look up key votes and zap this one or the other.
Did anybody ever review your selection list to see?
Just Bill.
Okay.
Just Timmons, yeah.
Did he overrule many of your selections?
Well, we have little discussions about them.
And by and large, he accepted
it. We discuss why so-and-so was or wasn't on a list, and I gave him my views, and I usually won.
And it was, in many cases, based upon how they've been supporting the White House.
Well, what they've said, and he looked at me and says, did he say that? Got a news clip here.
No kidding.
We had a lot of fun with socials. And leadership, when you had wild cards for leadership, that was the frivolous part of it, the socials, but...
Nevertheless, it's interesting to provide some insight into it.
No, he'd ask, drop a list for so-and-so and such, and I'd do it, and a lot of times he'd cut out and chop and so on, but I always felt as long as you had a list in front of you, that's half your battle. And I'd cover as many committees as I could for a bipartisan leadership. And he could chop and cut because I wasn't egotistical. I mean, you know, this is something to work from, and it saves you from looking through the book. And that was the object of the work. You know, like I said, whenever I get a question in, I do him a draft memo. It either fly or fly not. But that was half the battle. He has something in front of him that he can chop up rather than write the whole thing.
Were you ever responsible for keeping track on a continuing basis of votes on a particular bill or tracing a bill through the House or the Senate side?
No, we didn't have that problem because we had so many periodicals. And as far as keeping track of any certain issue, you could get it from any of your weeklies. And the only thing would be basic research, you know, how so-and-so voted on such and such a votes.
Would he ever call you and say, Kay, find out how the vote went on this particular bill?
Yeah, quite often. And who voted for and against, and we'd have a little comparison sheet and stuff. We do. That's what I call basic research.
So you were a research assistant in addition to everything else?
Interested.
50 years from now, somebody wanted to trace your role in the office. Are they going to be able to go through the files that are over there and pretty well grasp and understand who you were, what you did, what your assignments were?
No, because I put very little of my name on anything. I did everything under Timmons' signature, which he would sign. I would draft it from a phone call or some other such thing and send it out. So for records, there's very little under my signature or even initials.
Would it be fair to say that just about everything that Bill Timmons signed, whether it was a memo or a letter, that you had either seen it or drafted it or had some input into it?
It'd be fair to say that I had seen it all. I could say draft maybe 50%. Put my initials on anything that he gave me and I typed, I would initial.
So on the carbon copy of any outgoing letter, down there in the bottom, your initial might appear?
No, never initial anything. So anything without an initial is mine, including letters. I have a 95% batting average on presidentials.
Is that right? How would we be able to determine which one of those you drafted?
The ones with no initials.
Is it fair to say that the majority of presidentials that Bill Timmons sent forward for presidential signature were drafted by you?
No, it wouldn't, because our correspondence girls did, percentage-wise, 75%. I do the personal, and they do the more routine stuff.
Okay, well that helps to break it up then. We can assume then that the more personal type would have been something that you might have had responsibility for, mm-hmm. and the more routine would have been the correspondence you would have been in the office. Did you keep any sort of a diary or a log of your
no.
day?
Nope.
No desk calendar?
No. Well, I have a desk calendar. I left them at work.
You mean you left them over there in the office?
Mm-hmm.
Did we find much information on that?
Just scheduled meetings for Mr. Timmons. Nothing other than that.
Whereas it might not say much about what you were doing, it might tell us something about what Bill Timmons was doing.
Mm-hmm.
We want to try and reach you 5 years from now, Kay, or 10 years from now. Do you have any sort of a permanent mailing address?
No, I don't.
Well, you're going to be tough to find. How about family, in-laws, professional organizations, university alumni association?
Let's see. Family I have. I have a mother who lives with me.
So whatever your current mailing address is now is also hers.
Mm-hmm. I have a brother who's older, lives in Bowie, Maryland. He's got 5 little kids.
What's his first name?
Larry Lawrence. I have a sister who's younger, married with 3 kids, and her name is Ella Hannah.
How do you spell that?
Ella is E-L-L-A. Hannah is H-A-N-N-A. She lives in Suitland. So we're from around here.
That's right, you did tell me that you were a Washington, D.C. metropolitan area person, which is a rare breed.
And I have a father who lives in St. Petersburg, Florida. He's Edwin.
Do you assume that over the course of the next 10 years, at least one or two of these will probably still be a good address?
Mm-hmm.
Any professional organizations that you're a member of that might keep track of your address?
Nope. I'm not a joiner.
Probably if the RNC will have your current address.
I doubt that. I haven't stayed in touch with them either.
Really?
No. Well, I've moved a couple times since they've had their mailing lists.
Who has been assigned your responsibilities over there in Mr. Timmons' office?
Shirley Jo Hayes.
H-A-Y-E-S?
Just H-A-Y-S.
How many magazine or newspaper articles have mentioned you by name
Any at all?
Very few, if any. Zero.
Are there any articles that come to mind that are particularly lengthy, whether or not they're good or bad in terms of describing the Office of Congressional Relations at any point in its existence?
I think there have been very few. National Journal has done, I believe, two in-depth interviews. Our operation has been mentioned in a couple of the White House articles as far as Time Magazine goes and Newsweek.
Would it be fair to say that those articles that have appeared are generally factual and fairly accurate?
I'd be hard put to say that.
Would it be fair to say that they're something that may have a reliability factor of 50?
The first National Journal article, which was an in-depth thing, was basically good. The second one was poor. The rest of them have touched on it so vaguely that you couldn't make any determination.
The reason we like to know this is that 15 years from now, some researcher will stumble across these and not be in a position to judge them. But if he can read the transcript and get your opinion of it, you'll know just how much reliability or validity you should place in the article. And also, it gives us some idea of whether or not we've missed some of these articles. We try and collect as many of them as we can, obviously. Did you do much traveling while you were in Timmons' office?
No.
Outside of going down to the 72 convention in Miami?
That's it.
That was the only traveling you did. Did you ever do any public speaking?
No. Privately, yes.
Were your contacts, like Timmons, primarily with the House side of Capitol Hill?
No, they weren't, and I'd like to take exception to Timmons, too, because, you know, the last 2 years has been both sides. And the Senate business is built up immensely.
Initially, though, it was primarily the House side.
Initially, that was our assignment, the House side. But I'd have to say that we get both sides of the aisle in both bodies quite a bit.
It would be fair to say that in either case, your contacts would have been more often than not with the senior members of either the House or the Senate.
Not in the beginning, but as we progressed in title, yes.
Was there any reason for that?
Well, it's the progression in title, more responsibilities, and lack of time. I mean, you have to talk to your senior members first, your junior members second. Limitations.
And you, like Bill Timmons, did not go up on Capitol Hill to speak of?
No, I didn't frequent it. Only on a friendly basis, but not as a business proposition.
If at some point we get around to interviewing senators and congressmen and ask them about the way this office operated, would we expect them to make reference to you and for them to say, oh yes, I dealt with Cade Mulo as often as I dealt with Bill Timmons, or I always felt like I could call Cade and explain to her the problem, knowing that she would be able to get the word to Bill?
No, I don't think so. I think in isolated cases, you would run into that. Basically, they recognize the voice, I'm afraid, after the length of time, weren't worried with the name. And many of them with, like I said, minor problems, and some of them major, would unload on you. But as a rule of thumb, 90% of them couldn't even pronounce my last name.
Did you make many telephone calls up there with the idea in mind of simply talking with the administrative assistant or the legislative assistant? Rather than the senator or the congressman?
Well, I have to say that most of my calls weren't even geared to that level. They were appointments type of thing. If I had a real problem, then I'd settle for the AA, but that was isolated. So you couldn't specifically say any AA, any LA. Basically, it was on the appointments level.
And when you say appointments, do you mean by that you were calling up to ask if Senator so-and-so could come down and meet with Bill Timmons, or Bill Timmons wanted to go up and meet with him?
No, it was presidential. It would be, you know, can this senator or congressman come down and have a meeting with the president? Although I did do it with Bill Timmons, but it was, you know, 90% of the time presidential level.
You had then frequent contact also with the other members of the Office of Congressional Relations.
Mm-hmm.
So you were dealing with them on a daily basis.
Correct.
How about other members of the White House? Were there some offices that you were in contact with on a daily basis?
Well, depends on the issues, but I would think it's fair to say that we were in contact almost continuously with any office of substance within the White House. Because our rule of thumb was the Congress calls you and asks for something, and you find out the information or find someone that can get back to them. You're talking about domestic issues, energy, you know, disasters. We would take the call and call the appropriate White House person and ask them to follow up. If it was that detailed. If it wasn't, we'd get the information and call the member back. And that was the guys we left because we didn't want to overburden other White House members that were involved in these issues with silly congressional calls.
Were these type of calls always directed to other members of the White House, or did you on occasion call agencies or departments?
It depended on the member calling in. If it was a question that you could obviously refer the individual to, you would. But if it was a senior member or an important member, rather than go through that exercise, you'd try and accommodate them, which means that you would call, like, Interior to get the information to get back to the member. Or call Interior, ask them to get back to the member, and call the member and tell them Interior handles that. They'll get back to you. It was that type of exercise. It depends on the importance or seniority of the member. On most of the cases, you could refer them directly. But if you have Jerry Ford, Mike Mansfield, or somebody like that calling, it's just easier in the long run for you to make all the legwork.
On the average, how many hours a day were you on the phone?
Well, the phone would start ringing about 8:30 and it shut up about 6:30. So I would say 10 hours a day. And then Saturdays was very quiet. So I'd say averaging 10 hours a day.
So I just can't believe that. I expected that answer.
And most of the calls entailed other calls. That was, you know, the whole problem.
I remember on one occasion coming over to see you, and you were on this one phone call for, it seemed like, 15 minutes.
Well, that was the guy that had a cure for cancer. We got him from Teddy Kennedy's office. He is a nut from Massachusetts.
But you really then would get these type of calls, and you just stay right there with them and hear them out. And
somebody asked me that once. It was a press guy. He says, why do you handle them? And why not? Because if you're dealing with a member's office, and you're nasty and snotty and tell them that they're barking up the wrong tree and they don't know what they're talking about, they're going to get annoyed and they're going to go to their congressman or their senator and they're going to give the member a completely different story about their handling at the White House. So what you get into is a conflict between, you know, the congressional office and the member's office and who's who a liar. So why get into that little game? So you handle them. You take care of them. And you politely tell them they're barking up the wrong tree, and this is where you should go. But why be nasty? Doesn't pay.
So on at least some occasions, you would get telephone calls from private citizens who had called their senator or congressman,
and
who in turn had referred them to you?
Oh, many occasions. Or, unfortunately, you know, the workload of the White House operators, and they knew we were always around, and we used to get a couple nut calls after 6:30. Some guy was going to be the next Prime Minister of Pakistan called me one night.
Now,
I have to tell you,
in a case like that, do you just sit there and patiently
listen?
You're very nice.
Yeah, well, what's the sense of being mean? I mean, they're calling the White House. They're getting an answer. The guy's going to be happy for the rest of his life.
And in the meantime, all of your work continues to pile up.
Well, it gets done.
You mentioned that the call started at 8:30 and was stopped at 6. Now, that obviously means that you were there at least for that period of the day. Now, what time did you actually come to work that morning, and what time did you generally go home at night?
Oh, we had a two-girl office, so we try and split shifts. And we had a girl in there at 8, which was early night. She came in at 8 in the morning. She'd leave about 5 or 6. And the girl that came in at 9 would stay until doomsday, which means till, you know, cut off. Timmons would leave and the operation was closed down. And that could be anything from 7 on, really. We haven't had many evenings after 9. But it's still, we averaged, including Saturdays, 12 hours a day.
Did you ever have to work on Sundays?
Very seldom. And the only time I worked on the Sunday was my own choice, to come in and clean up. Never got called in.
During this period of time, did you ever have many opportunities for annual leave?
We took a lot of comp time.
I had the impression that you probably never really had the opportunity for a week off here or there.
No, we get a week off here or there. Never any more than that. During congressional recesses, we try and split up. Like I said, you run a two-girl office, you split it by two. Congress goes for 4 weeks in August, which is fairly recent, so everybody gets 2 weeks. And Christmas, you know, a week or so, or Easter, you know, it's catch-as-catch-can.
You've probably mentioned this other person's name, but now twice in the last 5 minutes you mentioned a two-girl office. Who was the other girl that you were referring to?
Well, since we went over to the West Wing, we've had a group of girls. We started with Louise Yarborough, then we had Molly Brown. And Molly left, and gosh, who'd we have in there then? Isn't that awful? Molly left. That's right, Shirley Jo came in to be my backup, take over my job.
So it would be a case of initially splitting up this the day with Louise Yarborough.
Or Molly Brown,
and then later on Shirley Jo.
Makes me sound like an ogre.
Well, I'm sure everybody that knows you will vouch that's not the case. Your contacts with agencies and departments, whenever you get a call in that you couldn't answer, would you call the congressional relations person in the department or the agency?
Yes.
And then they in turn would have to get in touch with whoever the person was in the department responsible for the issue.
But see, we would in turn notify the member's office who we contacted. So that if there was any slip-up, it was the responsibility of the agency, where it was duly put anyway, as a follow-up.
Would it be fair to characterize the Congressional Relations Office as one that was just constantly responding to telephone calls? In other words, you've described the telephone calls as starting at 8:30 and not stopping until 6. Was everybody in the office under that type of working situation?
No, that's not fairly put, because the girls are the ones that held most of the fire, the telephone calls. The guys had quite a bit of latitude. They were on the hill and running around and so on. And the girls, I would assume, could handle 75% of the incoming calls. The other 25 or 20 would be left for the men. And most of those only because the individuals wouldn't tell the girls what they wanted, because I pride myself, because I think the gals we have are very, very capable. And they can find out just about anything within the structure as the guys. But unfortunately, most of the people on the Hill don't recognize this. Now, if someone called in with a certain problem, instead of waiting until 5 o'clock and one of the men came back from the Hill to call them back, they had told the girl the problem, she could have had the answer, or at least been working on it by the time the boss came back. And this has always been a great problem, and this is one of the, you know, like I said, I've been lucky because I developed a rapport with a good percentage of the Hill offices. But it's a silly thing, but it's indicative of congressional relations. Indicative of anything, I think.
No comment. Did you have much contact with the Vice President's office?
Quite a bit, particularly on the Hill. We relied on them very heavily because they were right off the Senate floor. And as far as the EOB operation and appointments and scheduling, we were involved with them.
As far as the 1972 convention is concerned, it's my understanding that Bill Timmons was very much involved in the planning and the preparation of that.
Mm-hmm.
To what degree did you get involved in that?
Well, as Bill's secretary, I was, you know, as involved as he was. Bill was given the chore of handling it from the administration standpoint. And he was keenly involved. And I was just as much involved, really. It's very hard to describe because the convention is a convention. And unless you've been through one, it's hard to describe. It's the biggest zoo you've ever seen.
Would it be fair to say then that at some point in the future, if we wanted to try and document or fill in any gaps that might exist in the paper records, we could turn to you and get almost as much information as we could from Bill Timmons?
You could probably get 75%. I don't, you know, there's a lot of telephone contact, which you have no control over, and you don't really know what's going on. But as far as working and paper and actual logistics, I went through the 72 convention. Oh, did I ever.
When did you start to get involved in that 72 convention?
Well, I don't really recall, because the initial site was San Diego, and that was sometime in 71. It was in the summer of 71, somewhere around there, spring or summer. I'm not really.
At least the planning for the convention started at that point.
Yeah, and the initial site was San Diego, and that fell through, and then we had to go through the whole exercise again with the Miami aspect. So I'd say I was involved in about a year, 15 months.
Now, as the convention date approached, did you find that 50% of your day was devoted to the arrangements for that, or was it always more or less a minor side issue for you?
Well, we tried to play it as a minor side issue, but as it developed, it was 8 to 6 congressional and 6 to midnight convention.
Now, is that the schedule that you probably were operating on, let's say, for maybe 3 months prior to the convention?
Well, it was flexible. It depended on what problems and stuff you had. I'd say is a normal thing. You broke your day, but you're still giving them pretty close to an 18-hour day.
Now, was this not only your scheduled, but also Bill Timmons and perhaps other people in congressional relations?
It was just Bill Timmons.
Was that right?
Nobody else in congressional relations was involved in the convention.
Who else in the White House staff was spending a considerable amount of time on the convention?
That I really don't know, because I don't know who was on the staff or who wasn't. You know, we have details and stuff. And the people that came to see us most was Stan Anderson, John Faust, and Bill Hinkle. Now, whether all three of them were working full-time, I don't know. They were Bill's three deputies. And how much time they spent, I don't know. They'd come over and see us for a couple hours and go back. What they were spending after that, I have no way to know. Stan, I think, was personnel. I don't know about the other two.
So if there were four people that we would want to talk with about the planning for the 72 convention, it would be Timmons, Anderson, Faust, and Hinkle.
As far as the administration standpoint, yeah. I don't know who was doing it for the committee.
Did you have much contact with people on the committee?
Not quite a bit. Telephone, not personally.
Anybody special, or was it just depending upon what the problem was, you'd call over and talk with this person, that person, or somebody?
Well, we used to, I think, funnel most of our stuff through Jet Magruder and Rob Odell, as far as requests go. Gosh, you talk to oodles of people, the press people, and so on, but not on a regular basis. As a regular thing, it would be Rob Odell and Jet Magruder. For
now,
scheduling and stuff.
When McGregor went over there, were you in constant contact with him for any reason?
Not really, because we really didn't talk to Mitchell that much prior to.
I guess I assume that since McGregor, let's say, am I getting my times mixed up?
McGregor was Bill's boss, but he took on a different function.
But then he went from the Office of Congressional Relations over to the committee, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought maybe that having worked in congressional relations, you people might have maintained a little closer rapport with him than, let's say, Mitchell or someone else.
No, because most of the stuff we were doing was on an operations level, not so much a decision level. It was a logistical thing. I mean, you know, setting up the convention and making sure it went properly and who was going to go and who wasn't going to go. And these are things you don't bother the campaign chairman with.
This touches on a question we discussed briefly, but I'll ask it again a little different way. As I understand it, the Office of Congressional Relations was not as involved in setting up administration or White House positions on legislative bills. They would simply wait for, let's say, the Domestic Council, or prior to that, the Urban Affairs Council, or maybe the National Security Council, to draft a bill, and then Congressional Relations would take it to the Hill and work to see that it was enacted. Am I right or wrong on that, Kay?
Well, it'd be difficult to say. It depends on the legislation. The Congressional office always had the sign-off on anything that was transmitted to the Hill. They would review it. Now, if there are any problems in-house, we would get a shot prior to any submission to the Congress. I think our office reacted to many congressional things, but they were things generated by the Congress. Most of the administration bills we tried to get enacted, because we did have a piece of the action in that.
So it was not, it would be incorrect to describe the process as one in which somebody else in the White House could draft the bill and then run it in and lay it on Bill Timmons' desk and tell him to whip up to Capitol Hill and lobby on its behalf without giving Bill the opportunity to say, this is good, this won't ever get through, etc.
Yeah, that's incorrect. Okay. Yeah, we did have a shot at the stuff and try to clean it up and, you know, give a congressional viewpoint. This won't float, you know, this will fly, and so on.
So they were looking to the Congressional Relations Office to view the bill in terms of whether or not it stood much of a chance of getting through.
That's correct.
It wasn't as much a case of coming to Congressional Relations and saying,
do it or don't do it.
Do it or don't do it, or do you think this is a good bill or a bad bill intrinsically, but rather, how's Congress going to react to it?
Now, we always were pleased because we did get a shot at stuff. Perhaps sometimes not enough time, but...
Well, your office, perhaps more than any others, didn't have the luxury of a lot of time in any case, did you? I mean, it always struck me as an operation that had to operate on very tight deadlines. You really couldn't plan very far in advance on anything, and the planning was really out of your hands.
Well, you know, you have a Democratic Congress, and you have to sort of react in 50% of the time. What we send up, we do unfortunately get a short time fuse on, which we'd hope for longer, to take a look at and show to Ford and Scott and get a feel for it, but we're not allowed that luxury in 9 times out of 10. But I think that the fellas we have working for us have a good feel for the leadership and what may or may not fly, the mood of the Congress. And this has a lot of bearing on it. 6 months from now, a bill will float. Today it won't. And that's what you need. Is, do you introduce it this term or wait until the next Congress?
Would it be fair to say that contacts with the Hill were more or less evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans?
Surprisingly, yes. The Democrats called us almost as much as the GOP.
And you, in turn, would call them about as much?
Well, we really didn't call that often. We didn't generate that much business. But incoming stuff, mail and everything, would probably balance out to pretty much 50%.
It's simply a case of having to please the Democrats up there as well as the Republicans, because you need the Democrats' votes.
God, desperately. Simple majority.
Well, I've hit the questions that I thought about ahead of time that I thought would be of importance. Are there any topics or subjects that you think deserve some time? I'll sit here and listen to you.
No, I think you've done very well.
Well, I'm shooting blind on most of these because we just kind of feel our way along and hopefully hit the main.
Well, I think the most difficult thing in the world is try and describe a congressional operation. I mean, it's just everything and anything. And it goes from the importance to the mediocre, but it's an important function.
And even structurally, it's not fair to try and lock it in and say this is the way it always was.
No, because we've always been very fluid, and I hope that came across, because I try to describe it that way, because you have to be. And if we have a problem with a Senate vote, the House guys are helping out. I mean, they're working on the House guys to work on their senators. I mean, it's as simple as that. You want to get something through.
Did you people ever make contact with state officials and try and get them to go to the senators or congressmen to lobby on your behalf?
Well, we have, I don't know whether this is for public knowledge, we have used lobbyist groups for special interest things that people are interested in, and they in turn will go to the mayors, the governors, and then of course there's the governor's operation around the White House. And you know, you call them and say, could you put a squeeze on Senator so-and-so, if it's that tight or that crunchy. Normally we can do it on our own power. We've used cabinet people to help out on items of interest or where they have the most impact.
Now, would this be a case where your office would call the cabinet secretary and
our office, or we'd have someone else within the internal structure notify them and ask them to do certain things? They're not anything dishonest. They're totally above board. It's just, you know, just a little gentle nudge. Isn't that how you put it? But if you get a close vote, every little bit counts. And for, like, as an example, Rockefeller, to call some of the more liberal House Republicans from New York State doesn't hurt one little bit.
Now, would this be a case where you would, your office would call him directly, or would it be somebody else within the White House?
Nine times out of ten, depending on whether we knew him, you know, and we don't like to call cold. So if we know someone that knows someone, now like we know Rocky's D.C. rep, okay, somebody call like Joe Cannon or Joe Gannon or whatever his name is and say, we'd really like this, we know your governor agrees with this, would your governor mind doing, type of thing. And that's the way the system runs.
Now that little description, as you say, that's the way the system runs, that defines not only the way the congressional relations system operates within the Nixon administration, but it probably describes in a nutshell how the entire lobbying effort in Washington, D.C. operates during any administration.
That pretty much shows how anything works. I mean, if you know somebody that knows somebody, and you're going to call them and see if they'll do you a favor. And if they owe you a favor, they might. You know, it's the name of the game, unfortunately. Because many times things on merits just won't fly.
Did the members of the Congressional Relations Office find themselves spending a lot of evenings at social activities?
Well, I always laugh about my boys. They're funny. They try and split them up. They get a lot of invitations, and they sort of sift them down as to merit.
Did you yourself ever hit any of the nightclub circuits, so to speak?
Well, I used to hit the receptions occasionally. It depends on what they were and where they were and, you know, how important it was for somebody to show up. Because even if it's a girl walking in, you know, you walk in and say it's Congressional Relations, the White House, they're not going to look at the face. They're going to say, well, Congressional Relations, the White House showed up, huh? Yeah, that does a lot. Because you circulate the room and you say, hi, I'm from Bill Timmons' office. He couldn't make it. I'm here because of blah, blah, blah. And you get your points in. Because it's not a no-show.
That's interesting. And that's the type of information that I think is very valuable.
Well, it's not really hitting the circus because you don't particularly want to. You just soon go home and crawl in bed. But it's the effort. And like I said, they don't care who's there as long as you circulate and say that somebody showed up. And then when the boss shows up, that's great. They compare notes at the end of the season saying, Timmons showed up at my party. We used to pinch hit. Yeah, a little bit, not a lot.
What aspect of your job gave you the most satisfaction? Was there any one thing?
Yeah, success.
How would you describe success?
Oh, success, yes. Oh, it could be from anything, getting a bill passed to seeing a little old lady in Peoria, Illinois, getting a 100th birthday letter. I mean, it was just the great gamut. To see fruition of something that you've done. And it's hard to describe because I can get as much joy out of a little old lady, Tickle Pink, in Peoria with her presidential letter as I can from a bill signing ceremony in the East Wing with 150 congressmen present. It's the same thing. It's the same PR value. And not really PR value, because that's a dirty word, really. It's a good feeling.
Yeah.
To be able to do something for people without all the red tape and, you know, all the fall wall you get from a lot of things. And they still appreciate it.
That was interesting, because I think many people would probably be surprised to hear somebody from the Nixon administration, the Nixon White House, Office of Congressional Relations, talk in terms of success. I think in the public eye, many people have the impression that President Nixon's victories on Capitol Hill are few and far between.
Well, that's not true.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that, because I think that's important to note.
It's really not true, but it depends on what you describe as a victory. We've avoided many defeats. But as far as great legislative victories, we really can't wear a rosy crown, because the Democrat Congress refuses to give the legislation a decent hearing. And the Democrats do control the Congress. They won't permit bills to come out of committee. And, you know, there's no way you can cut that. If you try and bring it to the fore, it has to be I forget exactly terminology, some type of special parliamentary order. You need a majority of the votes, and that's overriding the Democrat chairman, and you can't get your Democrats to do that. So you're between a rock and a hard place. So you can't have any congressional action unless the committees will allow the legislation to come out on the floor and be heard. So that's sort of an impasse, really. But as far as victories, we've defeated most of the pernicious legislation coming along. And I think we have a very good track record. The only blot is the fact that they won't move on the president's initiatives. And there's virtually nothing anybody can do about that, except the Congress.
So you've gone into the situation with your eyes open, knowing what the odds are, and you haven't been discouraged by, haven't been too discouraged or surprised about the way things have happened on Capitol Hill. Knowing what to expect, you've been able to perhaps prepare and plan better for the victories that you've had. I'm not sure if I'm expressing that very well, but.
Well, like I said, we've had negative victories. I think that's how Bill would state it. And we've not lost anything. The unfortunate thing, and I think really, realistically, and the general public feels this, is the fact that the Congress is not doing anything. And, you know, you might have all your crises and, you know, whatever comes across every different day, every different week, there's something else. But in the long run, it's the fact the Congress is happy, the Democrats, with sitting on their thumbs and doing absolutely nothing. And this is noticed throughout the country. I just came across from across country, and they know that they're dwindling away. There's preoccupation with this, that, and the other, but we're not given a fair chance.
Is there any way to come up with a breakdown of the type of legislation that you probably have spent most of your time on? Has it been domestic affairs? Has it been foreign affairs? Has it been economic problems, transportation problems, social problems, or anything of that?
Well, I think we have sort of a semi-laundry list of 35 bills that were discussed before the recess, the August recess. It was late July. I don't remember all the bills, but they had to do with the environment, the Indians, the economy, just a whole gamut. Was it the reorganization of the government? And just a slew of things that were proposed, if I remember correctly, revenue sharing in many instances, that were proposed. Revenue sharing goes back to August 69. The rest of the stuff is back from the last Congress that was reproposed, and they've not even, you know, given us the advantage of a hearing. Committees haven't even held hearings on it. They've played around with the trade bill, and that's about it. You know, so there are 35, 40, 50 really important bills, and I think the president said many times is, you know, give us an up or down vote. No, give us the option of a hearing. You vote it down, fine. And this is what we've been fighting the whole time, is the fact that the Democrats will not give us a fair hearing or a fair vote. They won't report it out of committee.
If at some point we wanted to go into a lot of detail about the various bills that the White House sent up to Capitol Hill, would you be a person who could discuss some of these bills in depth?
No, not really. I have a basic working knowledge of the initiatives and legislation, but I couldn't begin to give you the arguments in depth, because they're broken down by departments and various White House functions and so on, and they're the better versed people. A broad overview, yes, but...
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, every time I say I can't think of anything else to ask you, something else pops up, but on this occasion, I honestly, I can't think of anything else.
I'm dry.
All right. Another cup of coffee.